Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Our topic of conversation today is antibiotic resistance, specifically the role that general practitioners can play in reducing the use of antibiotics out in the community. My special guest is Professor Chris Del Mar, who, apart from being a long-time friend of the pod, is Professor of Public Health at Bond University's Centre for Evidence-Based Practice. Chris and seven of his colleagues have written a narrative review on this subject, which is available at mja.com.au from Monday, the 23rd of October, 2017. Why the need for the narrative review?
Well, the first thing to say is that the narrative review arose from a national roundtable meeting we had in Queensland, where we invited policymakers from around Australia. In fact, we even had Dame Sally Davies, who's the she's the chief medical officer for the NHS. And so she's the equivalent of Brendan Murphy, the Commonwealth medical officer here. So we had them both at the meeting. So we had policymakers, and that included government, National Prescribing Service, Australian Commission for Safety and Quality in Healthcare. And then we had researchers, so people from our own Centre for Research Excellence, from another research Centre for Research Excellence in Melbourne, and other researchers around the place, to address the issue about what we can do about antibiotic use in primary care in Australia.
Is it all the GP's fault?
No, it's not all GP's fault by any means, but it's to talk about fault isn't helpful.
No. I was being provocative.
I can understand that. And what we need to do is talk about there is a problem. Why is there a problem, and what can we do to make that problem minimised? And I mean, the problem is that antibiotic resistance is, of course, a problem, and we've talked about that before. We're staring down the barrel of an apocalypse in which not only more people will be dying from antibiotic resistance directly than all cancer deaths put together, by the year 2050.
Wow.
In other words, a return to the pre-high-tech medicine of the 1930s and earlier. But also that the high-tech stuff that we've got used to,
yes,
and take for granted now, like major surgery, chemotherapy for cancer, stem cell transplants, hip replacement, you know, joint replacement operations, all of that, cardiac stents, all of that stuff requires reliable antibiotic cover, prophylaxis.
Yes.
And if you don't have that, then you can't, there will be a time when you won't be able to do that.
Yeah.
And we're rapidly getting to the stage now where we can't guarantee that there aren't bugs around which are antibiotic resistance, and therefore it'll be unsafe to use antibiotic to do those procedures. So what causes antibiotic resistance?
Mm.
Well, it's probably always there. The kernel of it is always around, and it's probably because that predates us human activity.
Yes.
It probably predates actually even mammals. It probably predates eukaryotic cells. So there's a war going on between microbes in the environment,
mm-hmm.
and the war they use are antibiotics and antibiotic resistance. So that's the weapons that's going on, and we just interfered with it. We just arrived in on that scene. We're rather unimportant members in terms of biomass with all of this activity going on around us. But still, for every human on Earth, and there's lots of us, there's 60 tons of bacteria.
Wow.
So we're grossly outnumbered.
Yeah.
And for every one of our own cells, there are 10 bacterial cells. So there's just millions. I mean, we can't contemplate how big.
Yeah.
The bacterial presence on Earth is enormous. But what we do know is that if you use antibiotics, then you induce more antibiotic resistance. And so, but the good news is that if you reduce your antibiotic use so you reduce antibiotic resistance. And that's because antibiotics are an extra burden for bacteria. It's like armor plating. If you don't need it on your ship, you know, if you don't have to deflect shells, then your ship can go faster and carry more cargo, and generally more productive, and will compete better. And so if you don't use antibiotics, susceptibility returns. So we need to look around, where in society do we use antibiotics the most? Well, they're used a lot in animal husbandry, and that's a kind of separate issue which is being addressed. It's being dealt with. We're not entirely sure of the extent to which antibiotic use in food animals causes resistance in humans. We've done a systematic review for the World Health Organization, which there's just really not very good evidence, is the bottom line. But there is enough evidence for us to think that if you reduce antibiotic use in food animals, you will reduce resistance in humans. And that's definitely an area that needs to be dealt with. But amongst the antibiotics that are actually given to humans, it turns out that most antibiotics are actually prescribed in the community. The vast majority of them are, 80%. And that we kind of think of antibiotic resistance as being generated in hospitals, because that's where it first started.
Yes.
The greatest concentration of antibiotic use is for sure. But actually, the total amount of antibiotics in tonnage is happening out here in the community. And that's GPs, by and large, mostly. I mean, there are other people do it as well, vets, dentists, and so on, but GPs make up the vast majority. What do they use the antibiotics for? The vast majority, more than 50%, is for acute respiratory infections,
mm-hmm.
coughs and colds, for which they do very little. What we're suggesting is we need to think of ways of getting GPs to reduce the amount of antibiotics they use, because there's now emerging evidence to show that that is safe, that reducing antibiotics in the community is likely, it can be done, it has to be done carefully. You could, if we just did it wholesale, you know, if you just stopped it, prohibited it, there would be safety issues. But we can do it on the whole safely in targeted areas. And we've just got to learn how to do it safely. How do we know it's safe? Well, because other countries use much less than we do, much less than even half what we do, and do not have any complication rates from infections that you would expect if antibiotics were really protecting the population. And there have been some other specific studies done which show that in places like Britain, for example, general practices which prescribe 10 times as many more antibiotics than the least prescribing practices have no significant difference in serious infections going to hospital as a consequence.
Yeah.
This is from enormous databases which can provide that information. So we've got to learn in this country how to emulate places like Sweden, where they have successfully started reducing their antibiotics over the last 15 years and done so successfully. Now, what this paper does is set out all the different ways that can be done. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of different ways of doing it. And some of them need government support. And some of them are things GPs can do on their own with some educational support and all that kind of stuff.
What are the sort of external regulatory things that can be done?
So the first one, actually, we talked about at the round table meeting that we had here in April, where Dame Sally Davis told us about how she sent a letter to every GP who was a high prescriber and was able to demonstrate, they collected the data and published it in The Lancet, that this actually reduced by a few percent, not very many, but by a few percent. Just getting a letter from the chief medical officer in Britain was enough to make GPs think, perhaps I'm a high prescriber, I better do something about that and prescribe less. So that's a pretty cheap intervention.
It is.
Professor Brendan Murphy, who's the chief medical officer here, the Commonwealth medical officer, I think.
Yes.
He said, I can do that. And he did it. He's done it. I don't know if anyone's collecting the data to see if that's having an effect, but he certainly sent the letter out. We know about whether or not, for example, we should stop people using topical antibiotics without a prescription. So at the moment, you can get eye drops, which are antibiotics with chloramphenicol in it, without any prescription at all. Mm. We didn't realize that until just this year. And that's, you know, that's, and that apparently makes up something like 10% of the antibiotics that are prescribed. That, you know, it's a huge amount that, yes, that is being dispensed basically by pharmacists. And we have no idea about the appropriateness of their use, but suspect very highly that it's often unnecessary. And in fact, even for most cases of conjunctivitis, antibiotic eye drops have been shown in several trials to be not effective. So there's one regulatory thing that can be done. The other ones might be more difficult. I mean, perhaps we should sequestrate some antibiotics which we're worried about, like some groups of antibiotics, so that they are kept on the shelf for really serious infections, so that we stop resistance developing in them. You know, and that'd be quite easy to do by making them authority only to prescribe. One of the problems, of course, is that a lot of antibiotics can then be just bought privately, and that bypasses the whole authority system. But nonetheless, that is, I mean, there are regulations that can be put in place. And I mean, I think governments are loath to induce regulations unless they're absolutely necessary. But there is an option that should be considered. And then there are other things. At the moment, we've got in a habit in this country of always prescribing antibiotics in the quantities that are packaged by pharmaceutical companies. You know, so for example, amoxicillin, 250 milligrams, comes in a packet of 21.
Yes.
Okay.
God knows why.
and that's all steeped in the mists of history.
Yes.
And there are some indications that use that up, but often they're not. Mm. And so if you say to people you can use your antibiotics for this many days and then there's some left over, people are inclined to take them as, but there's been this myth that you should always finish your course of antibiotics.
Yeah.
That's actually not terribly well evidence-based. We think that it'd be good if we could get pharmacists to actually break up packets, buy their pills in bulk, and then dispense them, you know.
Yeah.
So if you want to prescribe 15 tablets, that 15 tablets is what's dispensed.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, more. And sometimes the pack size is smaller than what you want to prescribe, in which case you've got to put a repeat in, mm-hmm. and then you get another, and then there's some left over from that. It's hard to get that right. We published a piece actually in the MJA about that. Other things are trying to stop medical software, electronic records, defaulting to repeats every time.
Yeah.
Sometimes GPs do that without even thinking through, oh, there's a repeat that came out on that printed script. And that sends perhaps an unintended message to the patient.
Mm-hmm.
They need to get another course. Or patients keep it and then next time they get something similar.
They self-medicate.
They get something similar or another family member gets something similar. They just go in and get the repeat done. Antibiotic prescriptions perhaps ought to expire more readily than they do. All prescriptions don't expire for 12 months. And it's hard to imagine many cases where you need to have an antibiotic that's current for 12 months later. So there is the sorts of little tiny some loose ends that need to be tied up.
Have you had much response from government agencies that would be willing to do these kind of regulatory things?
They're certainly thinking about it.
Yeah.
A couple of us went down to Canberra and had chats with the health department officials, and we presented our data to them. They talked about what they could do and what they couldn't do, and they're sort of thinking all of this through.
What kinds of things can GPs do for themselves?
Okay, so there's quite a lot of different things. Sort of the most obvious ones are things like delayed prescribing, and that's a thing where the GP writes the prescription and gives it to the patient.
Yep.
It says, look, I don't think you need this, but here it is in case. And then the in case is where they say, these are the conditions in which you should get it filled and use it. You know, if you get worse by tomorrow, and worse means stipulated,
mm-hmm.
or not better by Friday, then, you know, you set out what that's going to be,
yep.
then use it. And that's actually quite, it's a kind of, it feels like a double standard, because you're saying, here's a prescription, but don't use it.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think it's a kind of halfway house.
Yes.
And it makes patients feel safe. You know, they're not being abandoned. They're not being rationed. And it makes the clinician feel safer. They've put some backstop in place, which means the patient doesn't have to come back if they get worse, and there may be reluctance to do that. But there's something put in place, and it's been trialed. I mean, there've been randomised trials done. In fact, there's even a Cochrane systematic review of all those trials, which shows it has a huge effect. It reduces prescribing by about 30%. So it's really important. Another approach, which is completely different, is a thing called shared decision-making. So shared decision-making, we've written a piece in the MJA about that, is the process in which you set out with the patient, the doctor sets out with the patient, the benefits and the harms of the options available. So in this case, antibiotics or not antibiotics. And it focuses attention on how small the benefits are, which a lot of people, we actually know, that people grossly overestimate the benefits of antibiotics, grossly, 10 times sometimes, and don't think about the harms of antibiotics, which, of course, include resistance.
Yeah.
But there are also other harms that people just don't think about, you know, the rashes, the diarrhea, the thrush, the abdominal pains, all those things that antibiotics actually cause. So you need to put all those together and say, look, let's put these on the scales. How does this weigh up for you? And it's good to get into the evidence and show that, look, it takes... antibiotics make no difference to acute cough. It doesn't make any difference at all. And we also need to talk about what's going to happen when you don't use antibiotics, which means talking about the prognosis, which is important. So, you know, all that, so that's one process.
Yes.
The shared decision-making, by the way, also goes on to say, we'll decide this together.
Yes.
Tell me what it is you're concerned about. What are you anxious about? And how else can I help you? Is it the symptoms? Well, we've got symptomatic treatment for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if it's really important that you are well because you've got a job interview on Saturday or something, maybe you should have antibiotics because there is a small bit of benefit and it will help you. There'll be occasions where the doctor and the patient will agree to use antibiotics together. But very often, I mean, I do this in my practice.
Yes.
And I often have patients saying, oh, I had no idea it was so hopeless. Oh, there's no point, is there? No, that's true. It doesn't seem to be there. It depends on what you think is worthwhile. So that's shared decision making. And we're actually doing a trial at the moment where we're testing whether a quicker version of shared decision making, which is using things called patient decision aids, where you set out all this information in an easily digestible format for patients, tear off pad, which you can go through with patients and they can say, okay, so I get it now. You know, smiley face array, all that kind of thing.
Yes.
So that's shared decision making. Then there's some other things as well. There's audit and feedback. Audit and feedback probably has less of an effect. You know, shared decision making. There's a Cochrane review of all the interventions that have been done there, and that gets about a 20% reduction in antibiotic use. Audit and feedback is more like, you know, 4 or 5% reduction change in doctor's behaviour. There's less of it testing antibiotic use than it has for other things, but it has been done. And then there are other things as well. There's a thing called a nudge technique used in America. It's been trialed, where these are things called behavioural nudge.
Yes.
Where a small behavioural thing leads to quite a larger change in behaviour.
Mm.
So, for example, in this one that was trialled, GPs made up posters with a photograph of themselves that went up in the practice,
yep,
saying we're committed to conserving antibiotics in this practice, and sort of pledge taken in a slightly American way. we tested that down here in Southeast Queensland. It was GPs did it, and we weren't able to measure much difference. We didn't collect enough data, but it may have been one of the things that helped reduce antibiotic use.
Yes,
it did in America, like a sort of 15% reduction in antibiotic use,
okay,
which is worthwhile. So I'm working with the College of GPs who have representatives there, and we've got ideas for making the college. Encouraging the college to provide the educational support for adopting these things.
Terrific.
These are a bunch of skills that GPs need to learn to reduce their antibiotics safely. And it's not going to be done overnight. It's going to take years, I think, particularly if we go by the Swedish experience. Mm. They've done really well. It's taken them 15 years to half their antibiotic use. That's only a little bit each year, a tiny bit each year, a few percent each year. If we can start doing that now, then I think we'll be well on the road to averting disaster by 2050, which is when we think the apocalypse is going to happen, unless we do something soon.
You and I have talked in the past about how GPs, rightly or wrongly, think that their patients expect to get a prescription for antibiotics when they go in with respiratory infections or whatever.
Yep.
It suggests that we need a public awareness campaign to try and change patients' view of this subject.
Absolutely. Yep.
What was the feedback on that from government reps?
Yes, and in fact, they're doing it.
Yeah.
So National Prescribing Service, that's the responsibility of them.
Mm-hmm.
They spend a lot of time trying to change public awareness and campaigns about antibiotics and what they do and when not to use them. They don't spend anything like as much money as the French did. They spent literally billions. They had a campaign called Les antibiotiques n'est pas automatique. You don't get an antibiotic automatically. They started from reasonably high prescribing of antibiotics, but they reduced it quite a bit with that campaign. But it was very expensive.
Yes.
Very expensive.
Yeah.
You know, the same sort of level as the AIDS campaign. That really big money. But, you know, NPS is soldiering on doing it with much less.
Mm.
And they're trying to do clever things by using social media, for example, to get the message across. You know, look, I think all that's terribly important. The other important thing to note is that all of these interventions, all together, probably work in concert. They probably work synergistically. In other words, you know, adding delayed prescribing plus shared decision-making plus public awareness campaigns plus some audit and feedback, all of those things probably end up adding all the responses, more than adding the responses together. You start a wave of it. And so I think I feel reasonably optimistic that we can do that.
Do you feel like GPs are getting it? They're on the road to trying to change their behaviours about this?
Well, I have to say I don't yet. No, I think we've got more to do. I think that it's the problem for general practice is that it's hard to see that there's a problem. You know, they're cogging along, they're getting through all their clinics, they're busy, there are lots of people come in. They're managing very safely.
Yes.
It's hardly ever a catastrophe.
Yes.
Now, hardly anybody with meningitis is missed. People with acute epiglottitis, you know, all the really horrible, scary things. Those things are now really rare, and GPs are being very safe. And so from a GP's point of view, that's all good. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's not broken. Why fix it? We don't see antibiotic resistance problems because they all happen in hospitals. But I think that it's possible that we are creating the problem by prescribing in the community. But GPs often challenge that. Is there any evidence for that? The answer is not directly, but certainly indirectly. We're not at the situation now where you can say, well, you prescribed an antibiotic for that patient and then they died of an antibiotic resistance related problem.
Yeah.
That's not what's happening. Whereas what they do hear about is you didn't prescribe antibiotics for somebody and they died. So I think that it is slightly unbalanced. And I don't quite know how we can do that except by more and more publicity aimed at GPs and saying this is a problem. We are related to it.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably related to the fact that we don't have any measurable outcomes. So I think we need to also talk about surveillance, measuring how much resistance there is in the community and how many antibiotics are being prescribed in general practice. It's actually quite difficult to get that figure.
Yeah.
It gets conflated with other data as well. And how much... And then we can see what it is month by month and say, look, can we reduce that by 10% by the end of next year? We have an emergency and we have to do something about it.
Yeah.
And not just us. I think there's high prescribing of antibiotics in emergency departments. Infectious disease physicians tell me that surgeons overprescribe them for prophylaxis of wounds. And so there are all sorts of areas where we can act.
Yes.
But we all need to do it. And it shouldn't just be left to antibiotic stewardship in hospitals.
Mm.
The one big thing that hasn't been addressed yet properly are nursing homes. So there's data to show that there's a lot of prescribing of antibiotics in nursing homes, often with poor indications. And I think that we do need to do some research in nursing homes to sort out what's going on in there.
So the bottom line is we need to do something and we need to start doing it now.
Yep.
Thanks, Chris.
Kate, I hope that's been helpful.
It has, as ever. Thanks.
All right.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.